Hi, everyone. I'm Sherry, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sherry.
It's good to be here. I want to thank Billy for asking me. My sobriety date is January the 6th, 1989, and I do have a sponsor. She happens to be here tonight. And my home group is the Pass It On group in Roanoke, Virginia. And it's a great home group. And I hear if you don't think your home group is a great home group, that you need to find one that is. Or maybe you should not go somewhere else and ruin theirs. But anyway, I think it's all a matter of attitude, you know. It's all about whether I'm going there to give something or to get something. And if I'm going there to give something, any group's a good group. And if I'm going there to get something, my motives may not be in the best location. Although, you know, I do need AA to plug in, too. And I feel like I get my spiritual strength here. So I do have to go to meetings where I'm hearing the AA message and hearing it strongly, because that's what I need. So anyway, I'm going to try to stick to the format of telling you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now to the best of my ability. And I started drinking when I was about 9 or 10 years old. And I grew up in a family of drinkers. And really, up until I was school age, I didn't know that anybody didn't drink. Everybody I knew did. And they didn't just drink. It was all-out brawls and trips to the jails and the asylums. And so it was a very fearful childhood that I had. And I guess the first memories I have were just wanting to hide, slide into the woodwork so no one would notice, and be out of the line of fire. Because if you got attention in my house, it was not good. I never really suffered much from any kind of physical violence. There was a lot of physical violence around when I was growing up, but it wasn't particularly directed at me. But I was always afraid that I would be the brunt of it. And I couldn't have, most of the things I'm going to tell you, I couldn't have told you before I got to AA because I didn't know. But, you know, in hindsight and having been here and worked the steps, I know that when I started drinking, it was just because I was trying to kill the pain. And drinking was, alcohol was easy for me to get. It was always at the house. And I started out just drinking on the weekends. And I used some other substances that I'm not going to go into great detail with. But I will say that those things were either substitutes for alcohol or supplements to alcohol. I used them when I didn't want anyone to smell me. And I used them so I could drink longer and stay on my feet. So to me, they're all part and parcel of my alcoholism. So anyway, life was painful, and I was fear-ridden, and I always thought I was shy. And I don't know if I really was shy or not, but I stayed away from people. And when I got to be school age, I didn't want to bring anybody home with me because I never know what they would see. And it was embarrassing and humiliating. So I guess I started living in my head and dreaming of a time that I could escape as a youngster. And just living in a fantasy world. And I always thought, you know, if I'd had a different family, that my life would be different. If my circumstances were different, then my life would be different. And so, you know, I started early on plotting to gain independence as quickly as possible. So I tried to finish high school early so I could get away from home. And I ended up marrying as a minor just to get away from home. Of course, I didn't tell myself at the time that I did that I was doing it to get away from home. I told myself this big tale of romance and love that really wasn't true. But that's what I did, you know. I lied to myself about everything because I couldn't stand the truth, And before long, I didn't even know what the truth was. I just had to tell myself whatever I had to say to myself so I could just keep doing what I thought I needed to do. So anyway, I got married to somebody that was a drinker that I had met at a party. And all the people I associated with were drinkers. And if you weren't a drinker, I didn't want to have anything to do with you because you were dull and boring. But anyway, so that, you know, once I got to the program, I heard that we attract what we are. And, of course, I attracted another drinker. And I also attracted someone that had a lot of violent tendencies. And so, really, it really wasn't any different from home, exactly. It was just sort of like same scenario, different location, and different face. So that didn't last for all that long. But I did finish high school while I was in that marriage and went to nursing school. And before it was over with, there was all these threats of violence, and I just ran away. And violence and destructive relationships were all about my life until I got to AA. And it was just one after another. So anyway, I got out of that relationship because I was afraid that he was going to kill me. But at the same time, I really didn't know that I cared. You know, there was a part of me that just wanted to die and get it over with. So then I finished nursing school and I went to work. And my first job was working night shift. And that really didn't suit me much at all because I couldn't drink the way I wanted to. I went into work at 11 at night and I would get off at 7 in the morning. And I was pretty much a bar drinker, and I loved to go out in the evenings and drink. And I couldn't do that and then go to work at 11 because that job was really important to me. I was afraid I'd lose my nursing license. And that was my only means of financial independence and to be able to stay away from, you know, going back home and relying on my family, which I really didn't want to do. So I was determined I wouldn't drink before I went to work, but I'd drink every morning. I was pretty much a beer drinker because anything more than beer and I'd black out, I was too unpredictable, and I didn't like to black out. So I tried to stick with beer. So I'd gotten the routine of picking up beer in the mornings on the way home, and I'd go home and drink myself to sleep. And I just lived for the weekends or whatever days off I had so that I could just drink and drink like I wanted to drink. And, of course, if I drank like I wanted to drink, I never quit. But I knew I had to stop and work. I mean, I had to work so I could keep on drinking and feel like I had some measure of independence. So after I'd worked for a year at that job, I switched shifts so that I could drink more according to my liking. And I started working 3 to 11. And I think that's the alcoholic's dream shift, really, because, you know, I could get off work at 11. I'd always put at least a case of beer in my trunk, and then I would go off to the bar and drink until it closed, and then I had that case of beer left so I could finish, because a lot of times I wasn't finished when the bar closed. And so life was just a blur for years of living for the days off and drinking. But, you know, I drank every day. By then, I'm in my early 20s, and I'm a daily drinker, and I'm drinking every night after work, and then I'm really getting into it when I have some time off. And somewhere in that time, I discovered the morning drink because, well, I always felt so bad in the morning. And I know one day, my parents lived real close, and my dad said to me one day, you know, well, you'd just feel a lot better if you had a beer. Why don't you put some beer in that tomato juice, and it'll make you feel really good. And, you know, from then on, that was my solution to the morning hangover. If I didn't have to go to work, I would get up and have one of those. I think they called them red eyes. In the morning. Boy, I loved that. And that just got the day going, and it settled my stomach. And so anyway, I did all that for years, and I got involved in another relationship, and it was very destructive. And after I got to AA, I think I already said this, I heard that we were just going to keep attracting the same thing, and it would just keep getting worse and worse unless we changed. And that sure is my experience, because I got into another very destructive relationship. I was it was a lot of physical violence there, and finally I just was terrified that I would be killed. And so I ran away. I left the job I was working. I gave them this big life story about how I had this medical problem. I had to go away. I borrowed some money from my family, and I just took off. And I stayed gone from town probably for 6 months or so, and the money was starting to run out, and some things were going on at home. I felt like I needed to get back there. My sister was getting ready to have a baby. And so finally I said, well, I just don't care. If he kills me, he kills me. I'm just going to go back. So I went back, and I lost that job as a result of my lying. I don't want to spend a lot of time going into that, but, you know, I was so insane. I just trotted over to that hospital where I'd been working at and dropped off a notice that I was quitting at the volunteer desk and never looked back. Until I got sober. And I went back and got a job where I'd worked before, and they took me back without asking any questions. And when my references came in, they were very gracious to me because my references basically said that I was emotionally unstable and probably unfit for work. But this this nurse, and I never believed that, of course. I thought, how dare they say such things about me? But the director of nursing there at the hospital I was working at said that they would give me the benefit of the doubt, that I had had a good record there when I worked there before, and they would just see what happened, and she would just set that reference aside. So for the next year I worked. And I didn't quit drinking, but I wasn't in a relationship that was so destructive. In fact, I wasn't in one. And life settled down a little bit, and I was able to maintain. And I was able to function well enough in the job that when I got ready to leave, they asked me to stay. And they told me that if I ever needed a job, to come back and talk to them, and they would give me a job. But I decided that I needed to move away somewhere where no one would know me and get a fresh start. So I moved to Roanoke in the early 80s, and I really didn't know anyone there. I had this distant relative that I didn't know very well, and maybe some guy I'd met in a bar, and that was about it. And I moved to Roanoke, and I said, you know, it's going to be different. I'm going to make a fresh start. I'm not going to do the things I've been doing. And I didn't for about 3 months. For about 3 months, I went to work and I behaved myself. I was working 3 to 11, and I didn't go out to the bars, but I got bored real quick. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I started to feel comfortable in that new job, I decided that it was time to get out and meet some people. The only way I ever met people was in the bars. So there I was. I was off and running again. And in short order, though, you know, I was drinking so much that it was hard for me to get to work at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And some days I couldn't go. I would still be so drunk in the mornings from the night before that I can remember crawling to the telephone to call in and tell them I wasn't going to be there. And then we worked some 12-hour shifts where I would have to go in at 11. And I swear I was sometimes felt like I was sicker than the patients. It was just horrible. But, you know, in my head, I just thought that I was this fabulous nurse doing a great job and that they didn't appreciate me and they didn't pay me enough and, you know, all that craziness. So I'd been looking for a new job. And I was out one night drinking, and I slipped and broke my wrist. And I called 911 or whatever, and the ambulance came and got me, and they took me to the hospital that I was a nurse at. And I really showed myself. You know, I demanded drugs and screamed in the emergency room. I did have this fracture that the bone was kind of sticking out under the skin, and they had to, you know, pull it back into place. And they wouldn't give me anything for pain because they thought they might have to take me to surgery. But anyway, they didn't, and they released me the next morning. And by that time, I was so isolated that I didn't even have anybody to call and come and get me. And I went back into the unit that I worked in and got one of the night nurses to give me a ride home. And, you know, I never went back to that job. While I was out with my broken wrist, the other hospital I put in an application at called and offered me a job. And I called that hospital and said, you know, I'd been offered another job, but I would come back and work out my reference or my, you know, my time. And they were like, you don't need to. But anyway, so off I go to this new job. And I hated it, boy. I hated that new job from the day I went there. But I had this old idea that you made your bed and now you have to lay in it, you know. It wasn't like there was no flexibility. You made this choice. You're stuck with it. I thought about that. That was the way I thought about everything. If I got into a destructive relationship, you made your choice and you're stuck with it. So anyway, I felt stuck there. And it was a number of years that I was there just, you know, going from one unit assignment to another, trying to find something that suited me, drinking constantly when I'm not working, drinking on the weekends. And finally, I guess it was in 1988, in the spring of 1988, I hurt my back at work, so I was eligible for workers' compensation. Now, what I know today is that I think, even though I did hurt my back, it was a whole lot about my alcoholism and getting to the point where I was incapable of working. And so, anyway, but God used that time to get me sober, is what I see today, because I went out of work on workers' compensation, and, you know, so then the doctors put me on, I was drinking all the time, and they put me on all these pain pills and steroids and muscle relaxants and all this stuff. So I'm doing all that stuff together and still drinking. And that summer, my mother had, who was also a heavy drinker, and her and I had had this love-hate relationship forever. And anyway, she had this aneurysm in her chest that ruptured when they were trying to take her to surgery. And so she was, like, critically ill in the ICU for a couple of months, maybe. And that really tore me up. And I started praying for her. And to me, that's a turning point in my story, because when I cared enough to start praying for God to help somebody else, He started to work for me. Now, I couldn't see this at the time, but so anyway, and I guess I should say that before that happened, I had married. About the time I went to work at this job that I hated, I met this guy in the bar, and I was in my late 20s, and I kept thinking, you know, something's wrong with me, and I just need a normal life. So if I would just get married and have some kids, I would be normal. So I find this guy in a bar, and we get married, and, you know it's not a good idea. Even in all my drinking, I know it's not a good idea, and I get this terrible feeling in my gut that, you know, just don't do this. But I just say, oh, don't be silly. You just have nerves, pre-wedding jitters. It'll be fine. So I just charge forth. That was my philosophy, charge forth and do it Sherry's way. So anyway, I charge forth and I marry this man, and it was a disaster. And he was a heavier drinker than me, and he had started getting the consequences that I hadn't got yet. He was already making the trips to the hospitals and the jails, and so it was bad. And so so now, on top of that bad marriage, my mom is in the hospital, and so I'm praying for her. And so that fall, I go join the church because I'm just looking for some help. And really, I don't know that I'm an alcoholic. For years, from the time I'd been started drinking, I'd been telling myself, I'm never going to turn out like my parents. I'll never be like them. I was just so disgusted with the way they lived. And before it was over with, of course, I was just like them. But so that's kind of setting the stage for what happened. So I go and join this church because I just know I need help, but I don't know what kind of help I need. And I start talking to the minister, or I'm trying to talk to the minister because I want to just tell him all my problems. But he didn't want to listen to my problems. And I've said to him that I'm married to this alcoholic. So he tells me to go to Al-Anon. I don't really want to go to Al-Anon. But I've been talking to my mother-in-law some. I loved my mother-in-law. I liked my mother-in-law better than my husband. And maybe I married him to get his family because, you know, he had a nice mother and we got along well together. So I had talked to her some, and I wanted her to think I was the good wife and doing everything I could to make this marriage work. So after having had some conversations with her, I felt like if I didn't go to Al-Anon, I would look bad. So I started going to Al-Anon so I could look good in her eyes. But I qualified for Al-Anon, too. And so anyway, I think the first thing I heard, one of the first things I heard in Al-Anon was that if there's an argument, you don't have to stay in the room. You could leave the room. And I thought, my goodness, I didn't know that. You could leave the house. What a revelation. So I started doing that a little bit. I started getting in my car and leaving when things started to get bad. And I started to feel a little better. But I'll say this, though, you know, that fall when I went and joined the church and started going to Al-Anon, I also went to my family doctor and told him about all the problems that I was having in my life. And it was my self-pity story of my mom and my marriage and poor me. But he told me that he had something he thought would make me feel a lot better. And it was an antidepressant, one of those old antidepressants called Elavil. And I'm not going to get off on this too much, but I did take that, and it made me really numb. And it was just a substitute for alcohol. But it was nobody would smell it. And so it was my solution when I didn't want anyone to smell it. Now, it didn't work quite as well, and every once in a while I just absolutely had to have the alcohol. And so I would drive an hour to get away from my husband so he wouldn't know I was drinking. And when I really had to drink. And in between times, I'd substitute that Elavil. So anyway, I'm going to Al-Anon now. And going to Al-Anon and doing all those other things too. And drinking. And so anyway, somebody at one of the Al-Anon meetings told me that there was another Al-Anon meeting closer to where I lived. And I might want to check it out. So I started going to that Al-Anon meeting too. And about half or two-thirds of the room was recovering alcoholics that were also going to Al-Anon. I had no idea. Now, by this time, I think I know my mom is not going to die right away. I think she may have ended up in this rehab or nursing home by this point in time. And the husband, I've just fed up with him. And I've been telling him to get out because we're living in my house and he won't go. He won't move out. So I was sitting in an Al-Anon meeting one night, and I heard this person say that there was a spiritual principle that those around us would either follow us into recovery or they'd be removed from our lives, and what we had to do was work the 12 steps. And I grabbed onto that, and I had been going to enough meetings to know that you had to have a sponsor to work the steps. And so with very poor motives, because my motive was that I'll work the steps and get this man out of my life, I went in search of a sponsor. I asked a couple of women in Al-Anon if they would sponsor me, and they were not some of the ones that were in AA, too. And they both had good reasons to say no. And so eventually I ended up asking this lady to sponsor me that was a member of AA also. And she gave me some reading assignments and said we'd get together. And, you know, she gave me some Al-Anon assignments, too, to read, but I don't remember what those were. But she told me to read the first 164 pages of the Big Book and the first three steps in the 12 and 12. And when I got that reading assignment done, that we would get together and talk. Well, we got together one night, And she started asking me questions about my drinking and how long had it been since I'd had a drink and did I use drugs and how long had it been since I'd had any drugs. And, you know, that really insulted me. And I thought, well, look, this is Al-Anon. Why is she asking me all these questions? And she also told me some things about alcoholism. Now, I had been a nurse for years, and I really didn't know anything about alcoholism. And they didn't teach much about it in nursing school. So the things she told me were real revelations to me. Like, one of the things she said was that it never crossed the mind of a social drinker to wonder if they had a problem with alcohol. Well, see, I'd been thinking that was my case ever since I started drinking, pretty much. And then another thing she said was that only alcoholics have blackouts, that blackouts are a symptom of end-stage alcoholism. Well, I had my first blackout when I was 13 years old. I didn't tell y'all that, but I woke up face down in a pool of vomit in the back seat of a car when I was 13. And so it just all went downhill from there. So anyway, those two things really got my attention, and I didn't tell her that night. But, you know, and the other thing she said to me was, because I did admit that I'd been drinking and using drugs. I did tell her that. But she told me I could go check out an open AA meeting. And that was her suggestion, that I just go to an open AA meeting. And I left there thinking, I'm not doing that. But I went home that night and I couldn't go to sleep. And I had the words alcoholic branded behind my eyelids in big red letters. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw alcoholic. And you know what? It was like I wrestled with God that night. And it was really like God said to me, you know, I'm going to give you a chance for a different kind of life. But if you don't take it, you may never get another one. And that scared me. I had thought I wanted to die. And really, before I got to Al-Anon, I had been praying every night to die. Just don't let me wake up in the morning, God. And but, you know, I'd gotten a glimmer that maybe life could be different. And so, all of a sudden, I'm not sure I want to die anymore. So, that really shook me up, hearing God tell me, you know, this may be your only chance. So I went to I can't remember if I called her the next day or not, but I did go to an AA meeting that next day with every intention of just sitting there and listening. And it was a small daytime meeting, and by the time they got around to me, and I told them I was there just to check it out. My sponsor had sent me there to check it out. But I said to them that my name was Sherry and I was an alcoholic. And got a white chip, which I hadn't planned to do. And this lady said to me, honey, that's probably the first honest thing you've said in years. And it probably was. But that was the beginning of my venture into sobriety. And I was real fortunate because I already had a sponsor and I already had a home group because I was going to go to her home group. I was too scared of people to do anything else, so she was my connection and I was going to hook on tight. So I started going to that home group and I was real fortunate because that home group was a real strong home group. It was founded in service and the big book. You know, that was what it was all about. And the second month I was there, one of the women recruited me to help her make coffee. And so I had wrecked my car that first month I was there. So she would come by and pick me up every meeting night and take me to the meeting to help her make coffee. And my sponsor said that I had to introduce myself to every woman that came in and shake their hand and welcome them to the group and offer to give them my phone number. And I hated the thought of doing that. I was so afraid of people. But I was afraid I was going to die if I didn't. So I did it. So I started doing that, and I started, you know, eventually reading and chairing meetings. And before long, they had me doing something at the group. I can't remember if it was the coffee chairman or what it was, but I started doing all those kind of things. And slowly, life started getting better. And that husband left when I was about 3 months sober. And by then, I wasn't sure I wanted him to go. My sponsor had already put me on to starting to work the steps, and she had told me I needed to pray for him every day. And so by the time he moved out, I wasn't sure I wanted him to go. I wasn't as filled with anger and resentment as I had been, and I was really afraid of being by myself. But he did go, and, you know, one of the things I heard in AA was that stay out of a relationship. If you're not in a relationship, don't get in one for at least the first year, because if you do, you're going to attract someone just as sick as you. And I could look back over my life and see what I had attracted, and I said, I don't want to do that anymore. You know, I don't want to attract anything like that, so I'm willing to follow that guideline. Now, there were occasions over the course of that first year when I thought that I would really like to have some companionship. Two things helped me there. One of them, I did remember that I had said that I was stay out of a relationship for a first year, but nobody asked either. That was a big help. That was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, you know? So, anyway, so after that first year, though, you know, I decided that I deserved to have a relationship, and it had been a year, and by God, I was going to have one. And it was a disaster, and it was all self-will run riot on Sherry's part, and I fell into this big, deep, black pit of despair, and I didn't drink, but it was horrible. It was absolutely horrible, and finally, I got out of it. But, you know, I think that was a great blessing for me because it kind of taught me a good lesson. And I'm not going to say everything went perfect from then on, but I was much more inclined to pray, Thy will not mine be done, and to tell God that, you know, I'm willing to never be in another relationship again. If that's what you want for me, I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to be alone from now on if that's what I have to do. And if you want me to have a relationship, then you'll have to send someone, and I'm going to quit trying to set the stage here and make my own choices. So, anyway, when I was about, 4 years sober, I guess, somewhere in that area, this guy that was at the home group asked me to a New Year's Eve dance. And I had noticed him before in the meeting, but I was trying to pray Thy will not mine be done and not manufacture anything. So, but anyway, he invited me to a New Year's Eve dance, and I was scheduled to work that night. And I said, okay, God, if you want me to go, you'll have to arrange it because it looks like it's not going to happen. And those nurses let me leave that night to go. They said, we don't need you. We don't have many patients. You just go on. Well, I'm married to him now. But that's been quite a blessing for me. We got married when I was, 4 years sober. Now, I guess I want to say something about meeting attendance, too, because it's been so important to me. I went to at least one meeting a day, and sometimes two, for the first few years in sobriety. And when I went back to work, then I probably went once a day for years. And finally, at some point, my sponsor said, well, maybe you ought to try to stay home one night a week and just see if you can be with yourself and be quiet a little bit. So I started trying to do that a little bit. And before I married this guy, one time I took this lady alcoholic that was coming to the home group in and let her live with me for a while. It was quite an experience. It was a great opportunity for me to try to carry the message to somebody else and to give back a little bit of what I had been given. And so that was a positive relationship. And I was encouraged to get to know the women and build some relationships with women in AA. And see, I never had had relationships with women because I didn't like y'all and I didn't trust you. And I just felt more comfortable around the men. So it was like I had to have a whole shift in my approach to life. So anyway, so then I did get married, and we have a son, and that's been another blessing. He just turned 16, and I didn't think that would ever happen for me. That was another gift from God. And then I'm a nurse, and I wanted to be a nurse practitioner since long before I ever got sober. And how that happened was, well, I'd been sober. I was married, and I already had my son, and I fired my sponsor. I felt like I was, well, I think it, the way I see it is I was in that kind of teenage rebellious stage where I knew it all and you can't tell me anything and I'm going to resent you no matter what you do. And so I fired my sponsor and left my home group and struck out into the wilderness for a few years. And I didn't get drunk and I went to a lot of different meetings, but I could never find a meeting that matched up with the home group, and I couldn't find a sponsor that helped me. I mean, people were willing to work with me, but I do believe God knows who can help us, and He'll direct us to them, and we have to be willing to cooperate. So I had that period where I wasn't willing to cooperate, and everybody I would try to get sponsorship from, I would end up sponsoring. It just didn't work. And so and my original home group kind of splintered into two, and, you know, neither one of them was like the original, so there was a lot of years of dissatisfaction in there for me trying to find a sponsor that measured up and a home group that measured up. And then, I don't know, I guess it's probably been about 7 years ago now, maybe. I'm not good with time, but anyway, a whole lot of people from that original home group that had splintered started going back to one of the splinter groups. And before long, you could just look around the room and there was a whole gang of us in there. And my original sponsor was in there. And I got up the courage to ask her if she would sponsor me again. And she said she would. So I said, I'm going to start all over and go through the steps again. So I started all over with the steps and wrote an inventory and did a fifth step. And in the process of doing that fifth step, I told her about wanting to be a nurse practitioner. And she encouraged me to check it out. She said, well, just do some footwork, Sherry. Just take one step at a time and start checking it out. And I'd been thinking maybe in a couple of years, you know, I might go back to school. So I started doing the footwork, and this was in the spring. And everything I checked out jerked me closer to school. So by that August, I was in school. Like just in a few short months, my life turned upside down again. And it was all because of making a new commitment to AA, getting reconnected with a strong sponsor, getting hooked back into a home group where I was accountable to people again, and working the steps. So anyway, so I was in school to do that, and it took 3 years. And that was a very challenging period of time. And my sponsor had went to school while she was sober, and she had said a lot of times how it had really impacted her sobriety. It was hard to be focused on two things at once. And I used to think, well, how could that be? I couldn't understand it because I hadn't lived it. But so I was real focused on making sure I went to meetings anyway and doing things in the home group, like, you know, maybe chairing meetings or something. But what I didn't realize was how detached I had gotten from AA, even being there all the time, because my attention was split off in two directions. So when I got out of school, I just felt like I was on this slippery slope with AA. I couldn't get my feet under me. And there was kind of like a halfway house in Roanoke, and I started going over there and trying to carry the message to some of those women, the AA message. And I never felt like it was particularly successful as far as them getting into AA and staying, but it sure did help me because it gave me some grounding in trying to carry the message that I hadn't got in all those years. I was always willing, but it seemed like there wasn't always a lot of opportunities. Women would come and go, and there would be a lot of times when I would end up just, I would do an other service work, like, you know, going to the intergroup or the district and doing something. And that was helpful, too. But, you know, there's nothing like sponsoring. There really isn't. So in that time of working at that halfway house and trying to carry the message, I felt like I got a lot of practice in carrying the message. And it kind of opened the door for me to start and get some people to sponsor. And that's been an exciting event for me. And I'm sponsoring a few people now, and they're keeping me really busy. and I have to get a lot more sponsorship myself and stay in the meetings and stay in the literature so I can have something to share with them. But, you know, it's also very exhilarating, and it gives me a lot of extra enthusiasm and energy. It's like a snowball, you know, collecting energy as it goes. So it was real exciting tonight to come up here with two carloads of women from my home group. And that's just such a gift. And the big book says that, you know, a fellowship will grow up around us, the fellowship that we crave. And I had craved that kind of fellowship all my life and hadn't had it till I got to AA. But, you know, now I know that I could have it anywhere in AA. Now I wouldn't want to leave my home group. But if circumstances and God put me somewhere else, AA would be there. And I would just have to reconnect again. So we're very fortunate people here that we have this opportunity to share the Spirit together. And I thank you so much for asking me.